Thank you, MC. So this evening's talk is about forgiveness. Every talk which I'm giving in the evenings here in Wat Chetawan is to help every one of you overcome some of the forms of suffering in your lives. Again, the Buddha's teaching were always to make sure that we lessen our suffering to get more peace and happiness in life. And that suffering comes in many, many different forms. And today we're talking about forgiveness. And I think many of you would understand that forgiveness is an important thing to be able to do in your lives. There's not one person in this room who hasn't been hurt by others. And there's not one person in this room who hasn't hurt others too. So unless we learn how to forgive, we're going to be carrying the pain and suffering of the past with us until we die and beyond. And part of the Buddhist teachings, a central part of the Buddhist teachings, is learning how to let go. And this is particular to learn to let go of the pain of the past and learn how to forgive. And in this talk this evening, I'm going to be talking about the two types of forgiveness. First of all, forgiving others. And more importantly, at the end of the talk, how to forgive yourself so that you can walk out of the prisons of pain which you built for yourself because of the events of your past. But in order to talk about forgiveness, we all know we should do it, but how do we do it? How do we go about starting and completing that journey of forgiveness so we can let go of the pain and the hurt and the cruelty of our past? And in order to tell you how to do this, then I'm going to start with the hurt which other people have done for you, first of all, because that's something which we can see very, very clearly. It is a part of our life which causes a huge amount of pain, depression, anger, and it takes up so much space in your brain. The anger you have to others who have been cruel to you, hurt you, cheated you, mistreated you, and that takes so much space in your brain that you have got hardly anything left to love and be happy and have a successful life. How on earth can you smile when you think so often about the person who's hurt you? So, starting with the hurt which you have experienced at the hands of others, I'm going to say that the way to go to forgiveness depends on the first two steps, which are the most important. Number one, just convincing yourself it's in everybody's interest to forgive. And number two, seeing something in the other person which is worth you forgiving them. Those are the two main steps. And I'm going to start with the first step is actually realizing the importance of forgiveness. When you start to look at what a person has done to you, that might have been many, many years ago, and they hurt you, and they were cruel to you, they cheated you, and they wrecked your life then. But why do you keep allowing them to wreck your life today? In earlier talks, I've mentioned that little simple anecdote when somebody calls you, say, ugly, and you think, why did they call me ugly? They shouldn't have called me ugly. I'm not ugly. And you realize you've allowed them to call you ugly three more times. Every time you remember it, they're calling you ugly again. And I've mentioned that as a way to overcome clinging on to the bad speech of others. They say it once, and once only you let it go. Now, of course, that same simile also applies to the hurt which you have received at the hands of others. That man had a mistress, and he hurt me. And every time you think of that, or see that man, or see that woman, you allow yourself to get hurt again and again and again. That business partner, I trusted him, and he cheated my company, and look what he's done to me. I've lost so much money. He hurt you once. And every time you see him and think of that event, you're allowing yourself to be hurt again. Does that make sense to you? It is just a very stupid way of using our mind when we decide to, we haven't done anything wrong. If you're the wife, it was your husband who committed adultery. You haven't done anything wrong. If it was your business partner, it was he who cheated or took the money and put it in some other cause. He cheated, not you. So why are you allowing yourself to suffer? In Buddhism we have the law of karma, which we take very seriously, but many of you just don't look at it deeply enough. The law of karma is that we are each the owner of the results of our actions, no one else's. So when someone does something wrong or cruel, don't own their actions. It's theirs. It's their karma. It was your husband's bad karma that he had the mistress. It was your partner's bad karma that he sort of spent all the money in the casino and gambling or whatever. It's not your fault. So number one, remember, don't own the karma of others. It's theirs. And if you get angry because, yes, they did a bad thing and you have to suffer some of the consequences, yeah, you might suffer the financial consequences and the marriage consequences, but don't suffer the anger consequences. You find out the law of karma that you are in charge of your mind, no one else's. Or as I used to say, don't let anyone else control your happiness. You're in charge of your happiness, no one else's. So don't allow anybody else to take your happiness away. If they misbehave and do wrong things, don't sacrifice your own happiness by getting angry at them. It doesn't make sense, because there are so many people out there, you can spend your whole life just getting angry at what other people did, and you have no life for yourself. It makes sense, if you really want to be free and happy, to let that go. What other people have done, don't let them hurt you. And if it is some terrible thing they've done, broken up your family, if they have taken away the money from your business, whatever, as I've been saying all week, there's always something you can do with what you've got. The truckload of dung, you could always dig that dung into your garden and get a wonderful garden as a result. Now, if you step in the dog poo on your way home, you always take it home with you and dig it under your mango tree. Sort of that, what a wonderful thing it is that you had to, that you managed to tread in the stuff so that you can have more fertilizer for your mango tree. So 1 year later your mangoes will taste sweeter than the year before. Why? Because of the dog poo. And I always tell people, as I said before, when you eat that mango, so sweet and juicy, you must always remember what you're eating. Dog poo transformed into juicy sweet mango. And that's a very good simile, because when you know how to use the pain and the hurt of your life, you can churn it into sweet compassion, juicy wisdom, which will give you so much happiness and happiness for the people around you. So first of all, it's in your own interest to let go of the pain of the past, and it's also in other people's interest to forgive. Because when we don't forgive, we are punishing ourselves and punishing others. And unfortunately, we live in societies which think that if we punish somebody, then they won't do it again. That if we punish somebody, that will be a deterrent. It does not work that way. You may all know that in the prisons of our world, whether it's in Malaysia, Australia or United States, when you send a person to prison for some crime and they get released, they go back there again. So is punishment really helping anyone? In Buddhism we don't do punishment. That was one of the things which I was really impressed with when I first came across Buddhism. There was none of this punishment and hurting other people. If somebody did something wrong to you, you just let it go. It was their karma. Why would you need to punish them? Karma will get them. If they've done something wrong, you know the law of karma will make them hurt eventually. So you don't need to punish them. You can actually put aside that responsibility, knowing that the law of nature will eventually get back to them and karma will hurt them. So you don't need to be the punisher. Karma will get them. But more than that, we find out that when we don't do the punishing, there's a sense of healing can happen. Look, to understand about punishments in Buddhism, I like telling the story of one of the young men who came to train as a monk in my monastery in Perth. They call them Anagarikas. In my monastery in Perth, you know, it's a training monastery for monks. So I call it not so much a monastery, but a monk factory, where we make monks. We've also got a nun factory where we make nuns as well. So that's my job. I own two factories. And of course, just like any other factory, you've got to look after your raw material first of all. So these young men came in, and I got to make sure that when they come out of my factory that they're good quality monks. You know, quality control, QC, is important in a monastery as it is in a factory. So we have a training there. And the first year of training in my monastery in Australia, they have to keep 8 precepts for the first year. And if they do well keeping 8 precepts like you're keeping here on this retreat, the second year they can become a novice monk, keeping 10 precepts. And if after 2 years they've shown by their conduct and just their commitment they're worthy of becoming a bhikkhu, a monk, then I will ordain them as a monk. So a 2 years training first of all. Now this was a story of a young man who came in to start his training, so we gave him the 8 precepts, and one of those precepts, as you should know, is not eating anything after noon until the following dawn. You can have some juice, you can have some chocolate, but nothing solid, no rice or no curry, no bread or whatever. And this young man, he'd been taking the 8 precepts for about 6 weeks, almost 2 months, and he came to see me one afternoon. He said, "I haven't slept the last night. I feel so guilty. I've done a terrible thing. Yesterday afternoon," he said, "I was so hungry. I went into the kitchen when no one saw me and I made myself a sandwich and I ate it. I broke my precepts." And so what did I tell him? I said, "It's wonderful that you've confessed. Thank you for telling me. Now," I told him, "there's other things you can eat in the afternoon, like get some honey if you're hungry, put a bit more sugar in your drink, have some orange juice or some apple juice or something, because you can eat that in the afternoon and that will stop you getting hungry, and eat more at lunchtime so you don't feel hungry later on. Okay, so thank you for telling me. This is what you should do so you don't ever do it again. Now you can go." And he said, "Is that all you're going to do? Just let me off?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Aren't you going to punish me?" I said, "No." And he said, "If you don't punish me, I'll do the same again." Because that's his character. So he really put me in a bind. He wanted some sort of punishment or penance. So I quickly thought, what is sort of punishment or penance does this guy really deserve? And as it was, that morning I was reading a book about the history of Australia. You know that Australia started as a convict colony, where the British sent the worst of their criminals over to Australia, and they treated them like slaves. And whenever any of those convicts in Australia misbehaved, they were punished severely by whippings with a cat of nine tails. And that was a very, very vicious punishment. But I'd just been reading that morning about how they would whip these convicts with a cat of nine tails. And so that being fresh in my mind, I told this young man, I said, "I've got a very good Australian punishment for you. I sentence you to 50 strokes of the cat." And this poor young man, his jaw dropped. His face went white. All the colour drained from him and his lips started to quiver. He thought, "My goodness, that's not what I wanted. Ajahn Brahm's going to whip me." And then I told him what 50 strokes of the cat mean in a Buddhist monastery. At that time, we had two cats. Find one of them and stroke it. One, two, three. And learn some compassion, you hard-hearted young man. And that was why he wanted punishment, because he didn't know compassion. And 50 strokes of the cat, you know, find a nice fluffy cat or kitten or a dog, stroke it 1, 2, 3, 50 times to learn some kindness. Because it's only through compassion and kindness can we learn the importance of forgiveness. So we don't have punishment, but certainly we have strategies to teach people to be more kind and more compassionate. Recently I was teaching a retreat over in my retreat center in Serpentine in Australia, and there was one Singapore girl who was on the retreat, and she'd done something wrong and she felt guilty. And when I was talking with her in an interview, nothing I could do could take away her feeling of guilt. We didn't have any cats in that monastery, but we had a rabbit. So I sentenced her to 50 strokes of the rabbit. And so she found that rabbit, and as she stroked it, she started weeping, to realize that she can be kind enough to herself to forgive the faults. It was a very beautiful moment for her, when she realized she didn't need to punish. Because what happens when you punish? Do you change? No, usually you still do the same things again. I remember at school, whenever I was punished because I did something wrong, all I ever learned was not to get caught next time. To be a bit more sneaky, so that teacher didn't find what I was up to. That's all I learned, how to be sneaky. And I remember just going into prison so many times, teaching prisoners about meditation, teaching them, you know, about Buddhism. And one day, because I'd become an abbot and because I was traveling all over the world, like here in Malaysia, I just didn't have any time to go to the prisons anymore. So I gave that job to another monk, actually several other monks. They're still going there doing a great job. But I remember on this one occasion, I got a call from one of the prison officers. He wanted to speak to me personally. And he said, "Now, Ajahn Brahm, I want you to come back to teach in my prison." And I said, "Look, I'm just too busy now, I just can't make it, I'll send another monk." "No," he said, "I want you." And of course I said, "Why me? Why not other monks?" And then he said something which I will always remember as a wonderful piece of praise, but also made me contemplate why I got this praise. He said, "The reason we want you is this: I've been working in the prisons most of my life, I'm shortly to retire, and I've noticed a very unique thing, that all the prisoners who came to your class, when they were released, they never came back to jail again, none of them. Can you, I don't know what you're doing," he said, "but can you please come back again?" And that was actually from a prison officer who spent all his life in the jails looking after the criminals. And I thought afterwards, what had I done which was different? How come when I went into a prison, I saw these people, and once they finished their sentence, they managed to continue without needing to go back and get a proper life? And I realized that one of the things which I had done was this: whenever I went into a prison, I never saw a criminal. In all those years I've been in prisons, I never once seen a thief, or a rapist, or a murderer. I've never seen any of those. I've never seen a criminal. Never seen one. And I've been to prisons in many countries in the world. All I've ever seen is a person who did a crime. I've seen a man who's stolen. I've seen a person who's raped. I've seen a man who was killed, but I've never seen a murderer. Do you understand the difference there? It's a teaching of Buddhism. It's just a psychological, just different way of looking at things. If you see the person and you think they're a murderer, they can never be forgiven. If you see a rapist, they can never be free. And of course you all know they are not a rapist, they are not a murderer, they're not a thief. They're a person who has stolen. There's so many other things they have done in their life apart from that crime for which they've been put in jail. And why do you define and judge a person just because of those two or three or four or five disgusting things they've done? What about all the other things they've done in their life? And of course, you should all know by now that story of the two bad bricks and the wall. I've told that story many times to those prisoners, and they realize that they're not criminals. They're not thieves. Yeah, they've got two bad bricks in their life, but they've got 998 good bricks as well, which means they don't need to destroy their life. When you see that they're more than that crime, then it's very easy to forgive. If they're just a murderer, then they don't deserve forgiving. They need to be locked away because they may do the same thing again. But if you think and see that these are people who've done a crime, not criminals, then you see there is a reason to forgive them. And because I saw the other part of those people in jail, because I never saw the crime they committed, I saw the other part of them, they saw that part in themselves. You know, when you're in prison, you have to wear these prison clothes. You've got a number. You're treated as a prisoner. You've got bars on the window. Everything reminds you of the crime you did. And they needed someone like me to remind them of the other part of their life, the part of their life which wasn't a criminal. And when I could remind them of that, when they could see that, they never needed to go back to prison again. They could be free. Why? Because they saw there was a huge amount in them worthy of forgiveness. The beautiful and the good part. One of those stories which really made me emotional when I first heard it, there were two of the prisoners in my class. They were in there for selling drugs. And don't think that selling drugs is not really much of a crime. Those drugs create huge problems for families. They split up families, they kill people, they ruin people's lives. It's a terrible thing, you know, to take drugs or sell drugs. So they had got into a little business of selling drugs. And they were in jail. And close to this jail, there was a local primary school. And the principal of this primary school, if I had a hat, I'd take it off to her. She was a very courageous and wise principal. Because in primary schools, even like 10 or 11 year old kids sometimes get involved in drugs in places like the US or Australia or UK. And she wanted to do something for her children to try and make sure they never get tempted to take drugs. Probably that happens in Malaysian schools, I hope. They're out there, they're available. If you really want it, you can get it in KL. And you've got to try and get your children to make sure they never go close to those things. So this principal wanted to have some sort of class program presentation. And instead of getting some professor from university or some sociologist who could talk all the theory but wasn't real, she invited two prisoners to come and talk to her children about drugs. Two people who'd been there, taken the drugs, sold the drugs, and knew the pain of the consequences personally, and could actually teach these children what drugs are really about and what it does to you and how it ruins your whole life and family. Now, it was a very courageous thing she did, because many of the parents would say, How would you allow prisoners and drug addicts to come and teach our kids? What are you doing? No, she was wise enough because these were real people who'd actually been there and done that and could speak from personal experience. And so they spent the whole afternoon teaching many, many classes about what happens, really happens, not with facts and figures, but with the pain of their lives. And you can imagine the effect that had on his children. But not just the effect on those children. One of those men, the prisoners, took me to this board. Because in this primary school, the teachers had been so impressed with what these two men had taught their kids, that when it came to their art class, asked the kids to send little cards saying thank you to these two prisoners. And had all these cards from these 10 or 11 year olds. No, thank you so much. I'm never going to take drugs. Thanks. Well, I've heard how it hurt you. No way. Hope you get out soon. You know, love, Sarah. And all these little cards from these kids. And when these men showed me those cards, these hard prisoners, they were weeping. Tears were rolling down their face. Why? Because they'd done something good and wonderful to make sure that many, many of those children never follow the path that they got drawn into, that they would be free of that pain. Now, that's not punishment. This is actually using the resources. And I say that if you have done that crime, you know more than anybody else what it's like. You should be the ones going into those schools or into those universities telling what really happens when you do things like that. Then it is real and powerful and has a huge effect. So instead of punishing, we actually make use of whatever we have done in our life and turn it around and make mangoes out of dog poo. This is actually the Buddhist way of dealing with things. So, but coming back to how I'm supposed to be structuring this talk, I've been wandering around a little bit. First thing about forgiveness, it's important to forgive, because otherwise that you are hindering your life, you are ruining somebody else's life. Forgive, forgive, forgive. And number two, how you can learn how to forgive is see something in another person which is worth forgiving. And if you want a little exercise to know how to do that, this is a story I read many, many years ago about forgiveness. This story was related by a widow in the United States who recounted an experience she had at her husband's funeral service. In the funeral services they have in many Western countries, and I think it may be becoming the same here in Malaysia, part of the funeral service is when the loved ones get up in front of the microphone and say something about the person who's died's life. It's called the eulogies, the good words about what that person did and what they meant to all the family and friends and loved ones. It's a very beautiful part of a funeral service when you're summing up a life, where you're celebrating the life, where you're remembering all the wonderful and happy deeds that person who did. And when the wife came up to give the eulogy for her deceased husband, she took out of her purse half a sheet of paper. And she recounted that her husband had this piece of paper before she had met him, and how he carried this piece of paper with him throughout his whole life, and how this piece of paper helped him forgive both himself and others who had hurt him. It was his little forgiveness paper. And she recounted the origin of this half a sheet of paper. She said her husband told her that he got this piece of paper one day at school. In his class of boys in some sort of high school in the United States, there was an argument in the classroom, and the two sides were about to have a fight. You know, even if it's in classrooms, sometimes the boys are boys and they wanted to fight and settle the matter with violence. and the teacher in the class ordered them to sit down and used his authority to make them sit down. And to solve the simmering tension in this classroom so it didn't end up in a fight once they went into recess in the playground, he told everybody to take one sheet of paper out of the exercise book and to draw a vertical line down the middle of that sheet of paper. And in the top of that sheet of paper, write the name of the boy in that class they hated the most. Their number one enemy, the one they were just so sick and tired of. Write his name. And then on the left-hand side of that line, write why you hate that boy. All the things they have done and said which make you so angry at their behavior. And all the kids filled the left-hand side of the page very quickly. Now, said the teacher, in the right-hand side, write down something which you like about that boy. Something which you admire and respect. And many of them said, can't do that, sir. Do it! And he ordered them, and of course it took a while to fill the right-hand side of the paper, but they could do that under pressure. And there was pressure on them to fill that right-hand side. And once they filled the right-hand side of the paper with things they admired and respected in their number one enemy, the teacher told them to fold the piece of paper along the vertical line and with their ruler cut it in two. And she came around with the trash can. The left-hand side, put it in the trash can. All the things you dislike and hate about that person, that goes in the bin. Now the right-hand side, all the things you respect and admire in your enemy, go and give it to that person with the name on the top. And she said, this is a piece of paper my husband had from his enemy. From the person who hated him, who wanted to beat him up, who wanted to get rid of him, who hated him so much, said this is what his enemy admired and respected in him. And that changed his whole life. If that's what my enemies can see in me, maybe that's what I can see in my enemies. In other words, he had taught him how to see the bigger picture. It doesn't matter what your husband has done, how much adultery he's committed, how much pain your business partner has caused, how much hurt someone has done to you, which means that you get so upset and angry at them. Sometimes you can get a piece of paper, write their name in the top, vertical line down the middle, and fill the left-hand side with all the terrible things they've done, the reason why you shouldn't forgive them. And on the other side, write down the good qualities. It's hard at first, but you can do it. And once you see all the good qualities, you realize they are worthy of forgiveness. You can forgive them because of those good qualities. Because of the good qualities in the prisoners, when they saw them in themselves, they could forgive the faults of their past, let them go. And once they paid their price with time in jail, they could go forward in life and live rewarding, beneficial lives for them, their family, and their society. They never needed to reoffend anymore. This is how we can forgive. We have to see the importance of forgiveness and a reason to forgive. So if there is any enemy in your life, someone who's really hurt you badly, and you find it so difficult to forgive them, try that exercise with a piece of paper. The left-hand side, throw it away as soon as it's finished. The right-hand side, the things which you admire in them. Look at that, and you realize they're not that bad. They are worthy of forgiving and giving another chance. The same with you. It's really fascinating for me as a monk to realize just how maybe we can forgive other people, but the hardest person to forgive is ourselves. Why you do that is absolutely crazy and madness. With other people, you can run away from them. You, wherever you go, there you are. There's no way you can get rid of you. And even if you commit suicide, it's the most stupid thing to do, because once you kill your body, there you are afterwards. Your spirit is still there. So you just can't get rid of yourself by killing your body. You're still there with all your problems and psychoses and depression and anger. So that's not a solution at all. So why can't we find another solution to the pain of our own past, the things that you have done, which you're not proud of, things which you have done, which have hurt others? Why can't you forgive yourself and let go of guilt? You know why? Because all you see is the things you've done wrong. So what you need to do is get a piece of paper. Write your name on the top. And on the left-hand side, be honest and write all the stupid, bad, selfish things you have done, which has hurt other people. Write them down there. Be honest. Get into it and write them all down. And on the right-hand side, write things you admire about yourself. The good things you've done in life. The very selfless acts of kindness, charity, compassion, goodness. Write those down. Tear it in half, throw the left-hand side away, and keep that right-hand side. Your beautiful and good, wonderful qualities. And then you realize you are worthy of forgiveness. You're not a criminal after all. You're worthy of letting that past go. And when you do know you're worthy, then it's possible. And when it's possible and you do let things go of the past, you feel this great weight taken away from your life. No longer do you need to punish yourself, which is what you're doing. I don't know how many women will not allow themselves to have a happy relationship with a guy or a successful career because they don't think they deserve it. This is ridiculous, but this actually happens. I know many women who are looking for a partner in life, they find a great guy, and they destroy their relationship. They destroy it subconsciously on purpose because they don't think they deserve happiness. There was with one nun who was visiting my monastery once, and this is for the meditators. She was visiting my monastery for 3 months and she was meditating, a great girl, and she was getting into some very deep meditation. She was on the edge of these wonderful meditations called jhana, which leads to enlightenment. And she said, I had this beautiful nimitta, this wonderful light in my mind. It was just so joyful and blissful, but it disappeared. And they said, why? She said, because I thought I didn't deserve such happiness. And that almost made me cry. I will never forget that moment. What do you mean you don't deserve that happiness? And she recounted some bad things she'd done in the past. You know, there's so many people don't get enlightened because they think they don't deserve to be enlightened. Guilt, lack of self-esteem. Many people aren't successful in life because they don't think they deserve success. Subconsciously, that prevents you from having success and happiness in your life, with your family or in your business. Don't underestimate that. You ask any psychologist, and he will confirm that. If you don't forgive your past, you will never be successful in your future. You have to let that go. You do deserve happiness, peace, bliss, everything. And so we give examples actually to show that. In Buddhism we have someone like Kangulimala, serial killer. And that's a pretty tough thing to forgive yourself. You know, anyone who has actually murdered, and I've met a few murderers in my life going to prison, they say they can never get that person out of their head. They can see it. They can see that they took someone's life. And it's so difficult. But I can teach them how to let it go. Focus on the other part of yourself, the beautiful, good part of yourself. Write it on the other side of the paper and keep that and keep looking at it. And you realize, my goodness, I'm not a bad person after all. There is something worth saving in me. There is something worth forgiving. And they forgive themselves. And they have this amazing, beautiful life. I remember actually that one guy. His name was actually Nick, the one who sold drugs. And the one who actually went to the school and taught the kids why they should not take drugs from the expert, the someone who'd done it and paid the price for it. I was at the airport in Perth waiting to meet somebody, and this guy put his hand on my shoulder and I turned around. He was in a very good suit. It was Nick. He said, look how well I'm doing. He said, I'm still meditating every day. And that just really meant so much for me. I'd got a guy who was in prison with no life and got him a life for himself, for his family, for his everybody. What a beautiful thing that is, to give that forgiveness and let people forgive themselves so they can go forward in life, never backwards. So you deserve that forgiveness, and if you can, the problems end. One of the most moving stories of forgiveness, which show how powerful it is, not on just a small scale, but even on a national scale, is what happened after the apartheid years in South Africa. As many of you know, for I don't know how many decades, centuries even, South Africa was split with the whites in the majority. That's in the minority, but they had all the power. And especially the Africans were totally suppressed, and the Indians too. And it took a Nelson Mandela to actually spend 26 years in jail. And as soon as he was released, did he look for revenge and punishing other people? Forgiveness. Amnesty. Let the past go so we can move forward in harmony into the future. And he had all right to seek for redress for 26 years of his life, which had been taken away and put in this terrible jail in Robben Island, which destroyed his marriage to his wife, Winnie. Because I know many prisoners, they tell me. Many prisoners tell me, it's on, I think. Wait a minute. Many prisoners actually tell me when they go to jail for long, the marriage actually breaks down. No wife can stay that long. It's a very rare woman which can wait for their husband when they're in jail for more than 2 or 3 years. His marriage broke down. But instead of seeking for redress of the terrible things which happened to him, he supported this great Nobel Peace Prize winner, Desmond Tutu, in his Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It was a brilliant path of reconciliation which many other people have emulated in times of national tragedies. The Truth and Reconciliation Council or Committee worked on these rules, that any person from whatever side who did a terrible, terrible crime, as long as they were honest and admitted accurately to the best of their knowledge what they did in public, they were forgiven. They were given amnesty. There was no punishment. It was forgiveness, as long as there was honesty. And I remember reading some of the case stories, and this one really got to me, as it gets to me every time I tell it. You know, it just is brilliant, it's beautiful. Not only because of what happened at the time, but how it gives hope for the future of humanity and hope for your future as well. There was a white South African police officer who was confessing how he tortured and killed a black African National Congress member. He had to say in detail how he tortured him and eventually killed him in front of the man's widow. The man's wife knew that her husband had disappeared. She didn't know what happened to him. He disappeared in the middle of the night, never to be seen again. And now she was hearing what happened to the man she loved, the one she chose above all others, the father of her children, and how he was tortured and eventually killed. You can imagine the emotional tension. Apparently, the South African police officer was shaking as he told his testimony, feeling just so guilty and so ashamed at what he had done, but keeping it inside of himself. The terrible crime which he had committed was causing him so much suffering and his own torture, because you can never forget what you've done. It's always there, and he had to get it out. But you imagine the courage, saying that in front of his victim's wife, when he finally finished his testimony of how he killed this man. The wife jumped up. The guards were supposed to stop people exerting retribution, but the guards in the court were too slow. The woman was too strong. She jumped up, ran to the murderer of her husband, and hugged him. Hugged him and said, "I forgive you." He burst out crying. Everybody in that court wept. What a wonderful act that was, knowing how your husband had been tortured and murdered for the first time from the man who had done that. She jumped up, not to hit him or punish him, but to hug him and say, "I forgive you." That was a brilliantly wise woman who realized that the way forward is not more punishment, but forgiveness. And one of the reasons I mention that story, if a widow can forgive her husband's murderer and torturer, can't you forgive people who have hurt you far less than that? Can't you tell them, "I forgive you"? Because the result of that forgiveness is means that these terrible things will never happen again, or at least far less likely. If you exert revenge and you hurt the other people, then that police officer's family will seek revenge from the people who put their father in jail, and this sort of the tit for tat, the anger will go on forever. Whenever will there be an end to like conflicts between Israel and Palestine? Whenever there will be an end to the conflicts, in our world? There's only one way that conflict can end: with beautiful forgiveness. Saying, "I forgive you, even though you've hurt me so much." In Australia, the indigenous population of Australia, the Aborigines, have their own customs and laws. One of those customs they call payback. If someone has hurt your family, then they have to be speared in the thigh with a sharpened wooden stick several times. Worse, they have to be killed. And if you cannot find the person who did that crime, you take the nearest relation and you spear them. That's called payback. An Aboriginal elder, he's actually the head of the Aboriginal Legal Service in Perth, told me this story. There was a car accident. Two drunken kids driving a car had slammed into another car full of kids coming home from college and killed them. The victims were Aboriginals, Indigenous people. And the people who were drunk driving the other car were also Indigenous Aboriginals. That meant payback. The kids, two kids, had killed two other kids, which meant the family of the victims had to exert some sort of punishment on the families of the kids who drove the car. The kids who drove the car were in jail. They couldn't be caught, but the family could. And he told me that he was in the ceremony for the funeral when the father of one of the slain kids jumped up. There were police stationed in that funeral service because they knew that payback was demanded by Aboriginal cultural law and they wanted to stop it happening. But again, they were too slow. The father, one of the victims, jumped up to give payback to the father of one of the kids who committed that crime. He jumped up and he too shook this guy's hand and said, "I forgive you." He broke the custom. He broke traditional Aboriginal law, and everybody applauded. And he is now, even though he's a young man, one of the elders which people go to consult. Forgiveness meant no more hurt, no more pain, no more blood. If the alternative is the hurt and the pain just goes on and on and on. So we have to forgive. We've got no choice if we want to live in a beautiful, peaceful world. Those are extreme cases of forgiveness. Some years ago, I was giving a talk in the Taiping Centre in Lavender Road, Singapore, just after September the 11th. When somebody asked me, if you were George W. Bush, what would you have done, Ajahn Brahm? And I said, if I was George W. Bush, I'd have got on TV the next day and say, all those people who flew the planes into the Twin Towers and all the people who supported them, on behalf of the people of the United States and the victims' families, I forgive you. I forgive you. Now imagine what would have happened in our world if he could have said something like that. Do you think there would be any terrorism now? If he'd have done that, I would have been able to take my toothpaste on the aircraft. I wouldn't need to take my shoes off. Can you see how powerful forgiveness is and why we have to forgive? Otherwise, the pain, the hurt, the revenge goes on and on and on endlessly. As far as Buddhism is concerned, you have to forgive. You've got no choice. Karma will take the revenge. Your job is to let it go. So you forgive yourself, you forgive others. And sometimes people say, oh, if you forgive them, they'll just keep doing the same thing again. If I keep forgiving my husband's adultery, you know, how many times? 1, 2, 3 times? How many mistresses does he have to have? Someone once asked me that. How many times should you forgive? And the answer is always, one more time. What's the alternative? Hate, which just burns you up inside, eats you up, which means you don't have any happiness or peace. I don't know how many people have cancer because they're angry and they hate, because they haven't forgiven. That's no joke. So if you forgive, you're free of the past. If you hate, you're always in the prison of the past. If it's your husband, your wife, whoever, they've done the bad thing. And you know, a wonderful thing happens if you do forgive and you see the beautiful side in another person. That is the side which grows. If you hate, if you see the faults in another person, what you see in another is what they show you back, what they become. So if you just keep getting angry and upset at somebody for how they've hurt you, they will continue to hurt you again and again and again. Haven't you seen that yet? If you forgive, they tend not to do it again. But you've got to really forgive. You see the other beautiful side in them. Just one last little story, just how this works, big scale. I think I told this story again, but it just comes up into my mind. I repeat these stories because sometimes they fit in the sort of the context of the talks. When I was in Singapore, giving a keynote to the Institute of Mental Health 60th or 70th, 80th anniversary, when I told those stories about forgiveness, that was when that head of the Schizophrenia Ward invited me to bless his ward. And on the way there, talking to him, how do you treat schizophrenia in this ward? He said, I don't treat schizophrenia in my ward. He was the head psychologist or psychiatrist in a schizophrenia unit of the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. It's an amazing thing he said, I don't treat schizophrenia. I treat the other part of my patients. It's just like he'd drawn a piece of paper with a line in the middle, the name of the patient on top, on the left-hand side, all the symptoms of schizophrenia which that patient exhibited, and on the right-hand side, all the other symptoms when they weren't schizophrenic. And he'd torn that paper down the middle and thrown the symptoms away and focused on the other part of the patient, which wasn't schizophrenic. And he said he's having huge success, much more than you would anticipate. I know that you would have success that way. You're even forgiving the illness and focusing on the other part of that person. There's no such thing as a schizophrenic. There's a person who exhibits schizophrenic tendencies. There's no such thing as a psychotic. There's a person who exhibits psychosis. There is no such person as a depressed person. So if you think I'm depressed, you've lost the plot. There's people who have episodes of depression. You're much bigger than that depression. Remember that. Because you're much bigger than the faults which you've done in your life, which means you can forgive them. Which means that the person you hate, they're much bigger than the reason why you hate them. Therefore you can forgive them. And when you forgive them, the results, like in the schizophrenia ward of the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore, is amazing. People get healed. The schizophrenic episodes get squashed out of existence. The harm and the hurt, the ill will, the anger, the stupid selfishness a person exhibits gets less and less and less when you focus on the other part of them. Would you like to be forgiven for the harm and hurt you've done in this world? Would you like to put it in the past, learn from it, but don't dwell on it, and to say to yourself, despite what I've done, I deserve to be happy and free. I deserve forgiveness. If you think that you do, then you're 2/3, 60-70% on the path to forgiveness. And do the same to others. We have enough hurt in this world as it is, without carrying the pain of the past. Let it go. That's what the Buddha said. And if you can do that, you'll be free. Thank you for listening. Okay, that's unforgiveness. It's an emotional subject because I really try and push that as much as I possibly can. Okay. Yeah. Okay, very good. Here we go. There are some meditation questions in here. I'll do them very quickly because there's heaps of questions here. Knowing that monks are experts in meditating, do you have techniques on how to sleep soundly? I'm having trouble sleeping because I keep on worrying about things. Remember that if you can do something about it, it's worth worrying about it. But if you can't do anything about it, then it's a waste of time worrying about it. So at night time, you know, you're not working. You know, you're not sort of at home, you're not sort of the Prime Minister of Malaysia, so why do you worry about the economy? You can't do anything about it. So sleep soundly. So if you can do something, it's worth worrying about. But as human beings, we spend most of our brain worrying about things which we cannot change anyway. Isn't that stupid? Do you want to be stupid? So only worry about things you can make a difference to. It is impossible to transfer happiness to a person who is unhappy. How true is this statement? That's very untrue. I spend my whole life transferring my happiness to people who are unhappy. I really work hard and eventually manage to make them laugh, to tell them jokes. I don't know if you've heard this. How many of you heard the two-carrot joke? You don't know the two-carrot jokes. So it was these two carrots, they were walking down the street outside Wat Chaita Wan Temple when one of them got hit by a car and was badly injured. And so his mate, the other carrot, Mr. Carrot, he rang 999 and called the ambulance. And the ambulance came pretty quickly. And they put the injured carrot in the back of the ambulance, and Mr. Carrot went with his friend to the hospital, went straight into the emergency room. And the triage nurse realized the injuries were very life-threatening, So went straight into emergency surgery. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but if that's your friend, you're frantic with worry. What's going to happen to my friend? So poor Mr. Carrot was waiting in the waiting room, just wondering for the latest news. Is my friend going to make it? What's going to happen to him? And after 2 hours of surgery, the doctor came and told Mr. Carrot the news. He said, regarding your injured friend, I've got some good news and some bad news. The good news is he's going to make it. He's going to survive. He's going to live. But the bad news is, unfortunately, because of his injuries, he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life. That's how hard I work to try and make unhappy people happy. It can be done, you just do it. Just work on them. After a while, you wear them down. I wear them down. I had this the other day. This question, how can I help my mum who's addicted to buying 4D? She is already 84. And this habit affects her physically, emotionally, especially when she missed some numbers and very close to striking a big sum, even though she does not need the money. She's not a practicing Buddhist, but believe in Kuan Yin, and I will do some simple chanting every day. What you can do is you can say, look, mum, look, I have just got the job of actually selling 4D in the neighborhoods. So you sell her the 4D tickets so that she doesn't have to waste any money, and the chance of her winning are very, very little. And if you... And if she does win, you can just write her a blank, write her a check, which doesn't ever get cash. You say, here's a check, Mum, I'll cash it for you. She's 84, you can do things like that. And that way she can do her 4D and it doesn't cost you any money because, you know, you're just running the whole show. That's my idea anyway, I don't know if that would work. Once she was very sick, she told me that she's afraid of dying and promised we'll kick off the bad habit when she gets well. I tried telling her about rebirth, last thought, during dying moment, etc. She can't seem to comprehend and sees no connection to what she's indulging in. And soon when she's okay, she resumes her addiction. I'm really concerned. She's also very stingy in giving. This includes donation in all forms. But I'll try my best to encourage her to do something and also to do it in her name. To do dharma, do it in her name. Okay, sometimes that when you get old, you know, people are in habits, you can't change, you can't teach old dogs new tricks, they say over in Australia. So, indulge her, but see if you can protect her from wasting the whole family fortune by you doing the 4D for her. Chance of her winning are nil anyway, so if she does win, you just give her a check and then you say, I'll cash it for you, so you can tear it up afterwards. And that way that all the money she would waste on 4D, you can do dharma in her name. So that's one way. I don't know. That's just I'm just thinking on my feet. But anyway, that's maybe what you might try. If there really, if there is a turkey in the chicken, i.e. mistress, if there is a turkey, i.e. mistress, in the chicken and duck's relationship, what should the chicken do if the duck does not want to give up his turkey? Okay. These are really tough questions. You can tell him what happens to turkeys tomorrow. They all get roasted. So if your husband is playing around, look, tell him that, the three rings of marriage which I told you early on? What's the third ring? First ring of marriage is engagement ring, second ring of marriage is wedding ring, third ring of marriage, suffering, so what I told you is coming true. And just tell him, look, if you have a mistress, that's double suffering. Having one wife is enough. A second mistress is double suffering. And tell the mistress, go and see her and tell him all the terrible things you know about your husband. Because no one knows a husband like the wife does. And all his little idiosyncrasies which drive you mad. and go to the mistress and say, look, I'm not sort of trying to stop your relationship or whatever, but I thought I should let you know, because I've been married to that man for 10 or 20 years. This is what he really is like. You know, he snores in bed, he picks his nose. Do you really want to sort of, you know, have a boyfriend like that? And she said, oh, no! So I don't know, maybe try that. My grandmother is a person of her own kind. She would love, overprotect over someone she likes, and hates and disgusts someone whom she dislikes. When I was a kid, she treated me very badly. Not only did she dislike me, but she would go around and tell other people how bad I was, how much I do not deserve to be in this world, even call me a prostitute. There were times I almost wanted to commit suicide because of her, and I was only one child when I had the intention. I was only a child when I had the intention. My relationship with her is now better. I don't hate her, but I can't love her. I only respect her as my grandmother. But she started doing the same thing to my father, telling others my dad was useless, husband, not capable, etc. This is when my dad was jobless and ill and old. He passed away a year ago. But now my grandmother's target has changed to my maid. Instead, I can't stop myself not to be angry with her, especially how she treated my dad. What should I do? Okay, well, look, if she's got past a form on just saying bad things to other about other people, just tell the maid what, you know, she did to you and to the husband, and so the maid will not take it personally, just in one ear and out the other. That's just old people. Dogs bark. You can't stop them from barking. And sometimes old people are like old people, and they always sort of complain. That's what it's like. I've often noticed with old people. Have you ever noticed with old people, their eyes go? They can't see very clearly, they can't hear very well, their legs are very weak, they need a walking stick, and even their hands, they can't hold things. But the one thing of their body which gets stronger with age is their mouth. It's true, isn't it? So you've got an old woman there, his mouth is getting stronger and stronger and stronger, so that just happens. But you don't have to listen to what she says. She's just an old lady, just barking like an old dog. So just let the dogs bark, but just don't take it seriously. So when she doesn't take it seriously, if you get upset when she says bad things, that just encourages her. It encourages her to say more bad things. But if you totally ignore it and just don't get upset, then she thinks, a waste of my time saying bad things about this maid because she just doesn't listen to me. Even better, get like a maid, say, from the Philippines who doesn't understand Chinese or English. So the grandmother says, you stupid dog, you're dirty. And she just smiles, yes, because she doesn't understand a word being said. Sometimes that might help. But just old people being old people, don't take it seriously. Buddha caught Mahamoggallana nodding during his meditation after not sleeping for days. Was he considered striving too hard and not letting go? He did attain enlightenment after going through the hardship. Thank you very much. You have been a very encouraging teacher, and it's a relief listening to your words. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I agree with that. And yeah, he was getting dull, but this is for the meditators. Look, he was getting very sleepy and nodding. And in a couple of weeks after that, he became enlightened with the great psychic powers. So all of you have been nodding during this retreat. You could be the next Mahamoggallana in Malaysia. You could be flying through the air and doing amazing things, you know, for Malaysian Buddhism. So all you nodders, you've got great potential. Be kind. How to forgive a man. He stays in Perth. It's not me, is it? No, it can't be. Because he's had 3 wives, 6 children altogether, but 3 of the wives were divorced. Later he had 3 girlfriends. For the 4th girlfriend, so he had 3 wives and 4 girlfriends. He promised to change and there would be no other, but lately he left her for another. How to advise this kind of man so that he stops hurting others, and what will his karma be? So he's had 3 wives and 4 girlfriends, and I think you should put an ad in the paper to all the girls, beware of this man. He's had 3 wives and 4 girlfriends, so do you think you have any chance of being the love of his life? Absolutely no way. He's got 4. And he'd be very lonely. Because don't ever think that men just can do this without thinking they've done wrong. Everybody has a conscience. That's another thing which I remember from going to prisons. You know, some of these prisoners, when you first met them, they were just bravado. I haven't done anything. I just had to do this. People deserved. I never actually robbed any people. I just robbed houses, one of the people said. Just to take away the guilt. But then when I got to know them very well, they would actually come and tell me, just everyone said the same. There's not a day goes past when I don't regret what I did. I just wish I had not have done that. They do have conscience, they do have guilt. And this guy will have guilt as well. I just wouldn't like to be in his mind when he dies, when he thinks of all the hurt and harm which he has caused. So that kind of man, tell him to come and see me pretty quickly to get forgiven and stop messing around again, because he's going to hurt himself enormously. He probably knows that. He probably has lots of alcohol or drugs. Because many people, actually, the only way they can escape from the guilt and the hurt they've done is to take alcohol or drugs, to blind their mind from the hurt they've done. It's a poor guy, he's done stupid things. Ajahn Brahm, the late Chief Reverend Dhammanandi, in one of his talks, says something like this: lay people, you are not monks. You have your duties and responsibilities. They're like feeding me. No, he never said that. Man. Contentment does not mean you cannot be wealthy or aim for success. Buddhism is not against riches or success. In the pursuit of wealth and success, you must be prepared to pay a heavy price. You might be overcome by greed, may neglect your spouse, your family health, etc. That is why you need wisdom and understanding the meaning and value of contentment. Can Ajahn expand on this? You've got to be very, very careful, because in the search for riches and wealth, sometimes you do pay a heavy price. Is it really worth it? And that's always the question I tell people. Now, is it really worth it? The riches and the wealth when you can't have any time to spend it. Yeah, you're very wealthy and very rich, and you end up being the richest person in the cemetery. So you can't enjoy your wealth. So what are you getting the wealth and the riches for? And I mentioned just beforehand, when I was interviewed with the Star newspaper, sometimes people think that the more you work, so the better your business will be. The longer hours you spend at the office, the more productive you are. And I think you should all know from your own experience, spend too long in the office and not enough time with your family, your family falls apart, and when you go to the office next day, you have all these problems with your family, with your kids, which stop you being productive at work. Imagine if you had enough time at home to rest, relax, be with your family, so when you went to the office the following morning, your mind was clear, rested, happy, because you spent a wonderful evening with your family. So you didn't have to worry about them when you were at work. Your mind would be far freer to do the work. And I told the story to the journalist about, because I go to many business seminars, I teach CEOs about how to run their companies. And I said, I give the example of this engineering firm in Birmingham a few years ago, which won a prestigious business prize for best business practice that year. It was called Farrelly and Sons, an engineering company. And they won the prize because in 12 months they had trebled their turnover and doubled their annual profits. In 12 months. And they did that with a very simple strategy. They banned all overtime. No worker was allowed to do overtime. And as a result of that, they trebled their turnover and doubled their profits. And to explain why, just think about it. Every worker had to go home on time and spend the evening with their wife and kids, or with their husband and kids if they're a woman. So they had a beautiful family life. And when they went back to work the following day, they were rested and relaxed, they performed really well. Which meant that staff turnover went down to zero. In a company, you have key personnel. And when they get poached by another company, or they leave because of stress, or they leave because they can't stand working all those hours for your company, you lose a resource which takes on average about 6 months to find a person and train them up to that level they can replace the one you've lost. 6 months of losing key persons. Can your company withstand that? It really hurts, the bottom line. So when these people would stay there, the staff turnover to zero because the company was caring about them, and they were rested and relaxed. When they were in the office, they worked to such a high efficiency, they were so productive in those 8-9 hours they were in the office. They did much more than if they were in the office for 10-12 hours. Remember, it's not the time you spend at work, it's the efficiency. Efficiency, productivity. And people still think the more hours, the more you get done. And you know, I know, that sometimes you're at work so long, when you get tired, you make mistakes. Sometimes big mistakes. Your mind isn't clear. And those mistakes can cost your company a huge amount of business and profit. So remember that, efficiency. So really, if you want to be rich and successful, you don't have to sacrifice your family. You can have both, a win-win. You stay and look after your family, and you'll still be able to go to the office, and you'll be able to compete with an edge in this modern world. And then you'll also have your health, and you'll have the time to enjoy your wealth. As many people say, that they're rich in money but poor in time. What's the point of that? The banks enjoy you, but you don't. Out of compassion for the benefit of some of us who have insomnia, can you briefly demonstrate us the toe-to-head method of relaxation to reduce insomnia? Start on the toe, go to your head, that's it in brief. No, it just takes a long time to do this, so maybe I'll try and do that maybe tomorrow, maybe just teach that sweeping meditation, and then those of you who can't come tomorrow for the retreat, you can get it on the tape so you can hear it from there. It's a great way of overcoming insomnia. During the time of his enlightenment, the Buddha had insight into countless past lives. Can Ajahn share with us some of the well-known contemporary cases of rebirth? Oh, there's heaps and heaps of cases of rebirth. Like just one which comes to mind, I was talking about it a few days ago, because the English guy, I think, is gone now, but when I was growing up in England, there was a comedian who was on the television very often. He was a household name in England, but he never actually became famous outside of UK. It's a fellow called Roy Hudd. I don't know if any of you have heard of Roy Hudd, H-U-D-D. He was quite a well-known comedian when I was young. And he wrote this story in a magazine that the council in London had made a new one-way system, and he got lost coming back to from a theatre. So he got lost in London because of a new one-way system, and he turned down a road he'd never been to before, and the hairs in the back of his head stood up as a recollection came that he had been down this road before in his previous life. Now remember, in London, sort of those houses have been there for centuries. They change the interiors, but the exteriors stay exactly the same. So you can actually remember this was his street where he lived before. And fascinating in this story was that when it was a famous person lived in those houses in London, they have these blue plaques on the wall to say, like, Sir Alexander Fleming, the founder of penicillin, lived here. Winston Churchill lived here. Those of you who've been to London have seen those plaques which tell you famous people have been there. And that house had a plaque on it. Now, because I was born in London, I know some of its history. And that plaque was of a music hall comedian, one of the most famous people who were working in music hall in Edwardian times in London, a man called Dan Leno, L-E-N-O. And Roy Hudd remembered that was him in a previous life. He knocked on the door of the house, and because he was a TV star, they said, "What are you doing here? You're Roy Hudd." And he said, "In this life, in the previous life, I was Dan Leno. I lived in this house." And he took them all over the house and showed them what it was like when he lived there. And because he was a personality, he risked ridicule by writing the article in the newspaper. He said, "That was me in a previous life. I remember it all now. Just going down that street triggered these memories," and he recalled who he was before. It's a nice little story. He was a comedian in his previous life. And in this life, he carried on that karmic tendency, that character, to be a comedian in his present life. Maybe not as good as the previous life, but still good enough to go on TV. And that's actually how your character continues from life to life. So that's just one story out of many. If you want to read some more stories, just go on to the internet and Cases of Rebirth. Fascinating, of all the stories you can read. And anyway, for those of you who don't believe in reincarnation, don't worry, because you will in your next life. A friend of mine has a problem forgiving her father, who has done something bad in the past. She couldn't even bear to refer to that man as her father. She told me she had tried her very best to forgive him, but nothing works for her, as her father is constantly going back to his bad ways. How can I help her? Thank you very much. By the way, my friend is unable to personally attend this talk, as she needs to work to get the money to support her family, as her father is not working and spends a lot of drinking. I'm not sure if she mentioned he gambles too, but I can't remember. Thanks again. Yeah, okay, so to forgive your father, yeah, he does some bad things. You know, he drinks, he doesn't work, but look at some of the good things which he has done. In other words, the first step of forgiveness is listing down good qualities in that man, not just the bad qualities, which makes him worth forgiving. If you just focus on the bad qualities, which is quite natural because those are the problems, we tend only to see the problems. If you can widen your perspective and see his good qualities, you realize he actually has got many good qualities, he's worth forgiving. And then when you do forgive his bad qualities and you focus on his good qualities, you find the good qualities will grow, just like that schizophrenia ward. When you focus on the good qualities of those patients, the times they're not schizophrenic, those qualities grow. And you find he becomes a better father, because you're not just looking at his faults or reminding him of his faults. You're telling him, hey, you've got some good qualities in you. Can you remember those? And then he will develop those good qualities further. What you see in another person, that's what they show you, and that's what tends to grow. That actually works, but you've got to see his good qualities first of all. And everyone's got good qualities. There's no person in this world who's totally bad. I am a small-time businessman. Most of the time I feel that I swim against the current. Things are never easy. Money difficult to come by. Sometimes I want to give up. What is your advice, Arjun? Look, even as a monk, things don't come easy. And I've told you many of the things which I've had to endure in my life as a monk. You know, eating disgusting food, frogs, snails, ants' eggs, water buffalo placenta, disgusting stuff I've eaten. And I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. And as soon as I went over to Australia, I didn't have it easy. I had to work really hard all day. And sometimes you didn't sleep. I was sleeping on a bed, on an old door with a hole in the bottom. Maybe 2 or 3 hours sleep was all I get every night, and then you'd work like a dog all day. I worked so hard, and then continued to work really hard. Maybe not building, but sort of teaching and talking to you. I don't get things easy, and to build a monastery was very difficult. And then I sort of started doing things like helping bhikkhunis ordain, and that's not easy either. But life is not meant to be easy. Anything which is good and wholesome, which is going to move our country, our nation, our religion forward, is hard work. So the answer is no one has it easy. So don't think that you're somehow underprivileged, that somehow it's unfair. Why do I have to work so hard and other people don't? No, we all work that hard. And sometimes I keep on going because you've worked so hard. Pause a little bit and reflect on all you've achieved. Whoever wrote that. You're a small-time businessman, but you've looked after your family, you've fed them, you've survived so far. Remember that, and that encourages you to keep on going. Keep on going, keep on going. Life isn't easy. It's called dukkha. But keep on going. And those who don't stop will always succeed. Those who just stop and give up, they're the ones who fail. Keep on going. If PLP had... If PLP? What's PLP? They're people. Maybe people. This is SMS speak. Even as a monk, you haven't got any mobile phones, you have to learn SMS speak. If people heard many different methods of practice, how do you want one to apply? What at what time? In the same way that a carpenter has got many tools, got a saw, a plane, a sort of a screwdriver, and you don't use all the same at the same time, you find out what you need right now to actually to do the task. When you are cooking, you got your water, you've got the sort of the herbs, you cut up the vegetables, you've got the stove. You don't use the same thing all at the same time. You don't just always use a knife. Sometimes you use a spatula, you use a sort of to pound the sort of the chili into a paste. So you use many different tools when you're actually cooking, in the same way when you're cooking your mind. You know, in meditation, which is what you're really doing, you're cooking it and making a nice meal. Use different tools for different times. You know, the best chefs, sometimes they don't follow recipes. They just know, they see, I just need a little bit of salt, maybe a little bit of herb, maybe just slightly warmer. And good chefs are like that, they're intuitive. And good meditators are like that too, they're totally intuitive. They see, a little bit of metta. Yes, lovely. Delicious. No, a bit more effort. A little bit of effort, no, a bit more letting go. It really needs more letting go. And then you taste, you know, your stew or your curry, you know, your mind. And after a while, oh, this is delicious. Oh, this is really nice. And that's actually how you cook your mind. So that's actually the different methods of practice. Example, chanting and repentance practice for Mahayana, and then different meditation methods. Would it be confusing? No, you do use different methods in cooking. You do use different methods in business. So try and find out which one works. And if you have a big repertoire of different tools, it's amazing what you can do. Just I've got a big repertoire. I don't care from what religion or from what tradition. You know, you get a decent story, you use it, and it works. So might some methods contradict? No. Although each method has its purpose, but a mixed practice may not work. Of course it works. Like I've already told you that over in Australia, I eat in a bowl. Over here, I eat on tables. And so when we eat in a bowl, we have this big bowl, and everything gets put in the bowl all in one go, which is your curries, your rice, your bread, and your sweets at the same time. So I have had ice cream on spaghetti. So it's amazing. You can actually try different things. You haven't lived.
So you've had ice cream on curry. Give it a try. Experiment. Because experiments actually when we find out interesting combinations. Now, many of the dishes which you eat today started off as mistakes. Somebody put the wrong thing in, but it turned out it tasted nice. So that's actually where you get the new dishes from. As an object of meditation, the Buddha images which are available now are either too oriental, effeminate, or uninspiring. Try to humanize and visualize the Buddha will most likely bring Keanu Reeves, the actor who played the Lord Buddha in the movie The Buddha tonight. As a result, there is a risk of lust arising instead of inspiration. It must be written by a woman to really get someone Keanu Reeves. Please can be using your powers to describe as humanly as possible his physical attributes, so I may love a good a mental image of the Buddha to carry in my mind. Okay, you know there are some very beautiful Buddha statues. People who know the art of sculpture know that it was one of the great tests of sculptures to sculpt an image of the Buddha to convey neither male nor female because it's a universal figure, neither Asian or Caucasian or African because it's supposed to apply to everybody, with compassion and peace coming from the expression on the face. It's very difficult to do that. But every now and again, the sculptors succeed. And my favorite statue of the Buddha is the one at Sarnath in the museum just outside of Fabianus. And that you see in many, many covers of Buddhist books. The beautiful Dhammacakka Buddha found at Sarnath. And I've seen that three times. The first time I went to Sarnath outside of Benares, I knew it was in a museum somewhere. but there was no guidebook. You know, the museums over there were too poor to have guidebooks. So I had to try and find it for myself. I went down one passage and another passage, and I turned the corner, and there it was, on the end of the room facing me, and I burst out crying. To me, it's still the most beautiful Buddha statue I've ever seen. It perfectly encapsulates the peace and compassion. So much I got emotional. I cried. Beautiful. The next time I went there, I was expecting it. I knew exactly where it was. So I said, okay, calm down, Ajahn Brahm, it's on your statue. It happened a second time. Because there's something about this beauty which gives you this pity sukha, this joy. It's incredible, it's wonderful. I love that big statue. The third time I went there, I was expecting it. If I want to cry, I can cry. And I turned the corner with my disciple Sam. It was covered with a cloth. They were renovating. And oh, they're really so disappointed. We'd come all the way from Australia. And it was one of the highlights of the trip. I was waiting to see this. I get this big boost of joy. And they were painting the ceiling and it was covered with a cloth. I was disappointed. And without any request, the painter removed the cover from us. So there are some Buddha statues which do things like that to you that is absolutely beautiful. And because I'm a Buddhist and I've meditated a lot and I understand a lot, that just is so inspiring to me. And I think that must be devas around or something that's really powerful, that particular Buddha statue. So that's my favourite one. But it's so difficult actually to carve one out and make one. But fortunately there are many Buddha statues around in the world. So you can actually go to a shop, go to a temple, and when you see one you really like, which actually moves you, attracts you, go and buy it. I shouldn't tell you this, but we've got a whole... People give us lots of Buddha statues in our monastery in Perth. We put it in the library, obviously on the shelf, many Buddha statues. And when a person comes and says they want a Buddha statue, we ask them, why do you want it, first of all? Is it just for the garden ornament? They say, no, I'm a Buddhist. I just want something to inspire me. I said, okay, see these ones over the top there, on top of the shelves in the library. Choose which one you want. And they choose one, then they say, how much is it? And I say, nothing, it's yours. They give it to us for free, we give them out for free, as long as people are using them wisely. It's wonderful, I love doing things like that. But I love to see their face as well, because they've got one and they think, this is very beautiful, this is going to be expensive. Okay, come and tell me. And I say it's for free. I love doing that, because that's what Buddhism is all about. Just giving. You give to me, I give to you. So that's Buddha statues, but you can find one which is beautiful. I'm curious about the first Buddha, the 28 Buddhas that have appeared so far. From whom did he receive the seed of enlightenment? There's been countless Buddhas. I think our Buddha only talked about two or three Buddhas, but later on there was about six or seven, and that was extended to 28, but that's in the commentaries. That's very suspicious whether that's true or not. But the real reason is there's been countless Buddhas, countless universes, so infinity of Buddhas. There always will be Buddhas. People become enlightened. It's just part of our nature. So the 28th Buddha, previous to this one, he got his seed from the 29th Buddha. Goes on and on and on. Just like the chicken and the egg. How to forgive your enemy that never realizes their mistakes and hurt towards us very badly. Thank you. If they don't realize their mistake, that is their problem, not your problem. Your problem is to forgive them so that they don't hurt you. So look, you can't control them, but you can certainly control yourself. You can let go, you can't force them to let go. So when you let go of the hurt you have, it doesn't mean you're going to like them. It is that you refuse to let them carry on hurting you. You refuse to let them hurt you ever again. That's called the forgiveness. You let that go, that's their problem, not mine. And sometimes if you want to help them realize their mistake, be kind to them. Go Because when they're kind to them, they think, my goodness, this person, this girl, this boy, even though I hurt them, they're kind to me back. And then actually they open up and then maybe they can see that mistake. Because when they see something good in themselves, they're not so afraid of facing up to the bad parts of themselves. That's one of the reasons they don't see these things themselves, because they're too afraid of seeing their faults. But when they see their nice qualities, they realize, yeah, they've got wonderful qualities, and they can actually see their faults as well. For those of you in business, you can actually tell people's faults by using the sandwich technique. This is classic Buddhism, which I actually taught this in Colombo, and everyone was writing it down, to tell their workers this is what you should do for performance assessment. In a business, there may be some of your employees who are not doing the job, turning up late, not performing to how they should perform. And so managers have to do performance assessment. But they always stop up every time by making people upset and angry because they don't know how to criticize. You should criticize using the sandwich technique. Tell your employee who's causing you trouble in your company, you're just a wonderful employee. I'm so glad we hired you. You're always well-dressed and your qualifications are brilliant. People love you and they like you. You're a great worker in the office. So praise them first of all, and then, but. You know, your typing skills are terrible. But, you know, I think we could do something about that because we really value want you to keep on working in our company. So in other words, you praise them at least 5 times. That's the bread in the sandwich. Then the but, you know, that's where you criticize them. Then you finish with praising them. And what happens then is because they've been praised at least 5 times before the criticism, their ears are actually open. They're actually listening for the next bit of practice. And that's when you can criticize them, it actually goes in. Because if you go up to them and criticize them, they're not listening. Just like you're being criticized, you don't hear. You don't listen to it. I don't need that from him. But praise opens their ears so the criticism can go in. And then you cover it with a lower piece of bread, the other part of the sandwich, by praising them in the end so they realize they're not being rejected, that their good qualities are being valued. Because how many times have you been criticizing from really sort of so upset? I work so hard for this company, they don't know how much I've sacrificed. Yeah, I've done that mistake, but at least they should recognize all the good I've done. And you have to do that. So if you're a manager in a company, please employ the sandwich technique for criticizing all of your workers. And please do the same for your kid. Don't just criticize them. Your grades aren't good enough, son. No more computer games for you. You can't watch Liverpool on the EPL this evening. You've got to work. Your grades are no good. No, that's not how you treat your kid. Take your kid aside and say, you're just a wonderful kid. You're just so loving to your father and your mother. You know, you're so caring for your brother. You know, I really sort of admire just sort of the way that you do. You keep your room clean. But son, you really need to improve those grades. But you know, I'm always here for your other father, whatever. You criticize people like that, and they listen, and because you express the fact that you value them, they will actually try hard to mend their ways. Just as you would try hard if people criticize you in the same way, praising you 5 times first of all, then the cheese in the middle of the sandwich, and then afterwards the praise at the end. That's how you criticize people. Sandwich with lots of praise, and then it works. They hear it, and they drive change. Dear Jambuan, please tell me how to deal with regrets. I could have taken better care of my mother who was sick, but now she's passed away. Actions were spoken in haste, distress, anger, tiredness, but too late now, damage already done. You're a human being. I made mistakes when my father was alive. He died, and I couldn't say sorry afterwards. But no one is perfect in this world. So number one, write down all the wrong things you've done, like you have on this piece of paper. But on the other side, write all the beautiful, good things you've done for your mother. And how kind you were, how caring you were. Keep it in perspective. You say, my goodness, actually, I'm not that bad after all. Because if you focus on the two bad bricks in the wall, you want to destroy the wall. If you focus on the whole wall, the 998 good bricks as well as the two bad bricks, you realize you're not such a bad person after all. So you don't feel so guilty. You get the message of this talk? We feel guilty, we get angry, we can't forgive ourselves, we can't forgive others because we just focus on the faults, we don't see the other half, or the other two-thirds, or the other 90% of life. See the other part of it, and you find that you can let go of your faults. Why? Because you've got such other beautiful qualities that you're worth giving forgiveness to yourself for. And please know that no one else can forgive you. I can't forgive you, the Buddha can't forgive you, Jesus can't forgive you, no one can forgive you other than yourself. In the last line of your life, you are the one who will judge yourself, no one else. You did a mistake, you have to do the forgiveness. And you can, it's wonderful when you do it. I'm getting there, only a few questions left. Oh, no, more. Please tell me, how do I let go of attachments? How to feel detached? Easily, meditate. How do I let go of past earthly events that just seem to auto-play back? Easy, just meditate. How do I deal with anger, jealousy, envy, either from within or from others towards me? Easy.
Meditate.
Exactly. How do I become disciplined in practicing meditation? Try it, and it works. Okay, I'll go through it very quickly. Please tell me what is the purpose of my life. How to know the purpose of my life. The purpose of your life, whoever wrote this, is to become a monk or a nun. Do you agree? No. The purpose of your life is to find happiness. What that happiness is, and how it is, you become a monk. You have to find it yourself. Remember, it's not wealth, it's not success, it's not sort of having your name in lights on some movie. Your life is about happiness, so please find out what happiness is, and how it's achieved, and that becomes the meaning of your life. Whether it's in a partnership, you find that with the mistress, there's no happiness there at all. Take my word for it, don't try. We take the five precepts as yogis and on special occasions. Does this mean such precepts do not apply to those who do not undertake them? No. Adultery, that should not commit adultery, applies to everybody. Why? Because if you commit adultery, you hurt other people. There's a wife, there's a husband who trusts you. And they let you go out to work, and let you go out to do business. They don't expect you to betray their trust. Because without trust, how can there ever be a family? How can there ever be friendship? So they trust you to go out and not betray them. And that's one of the worst things when you do commit adultery. It's a breach of trust, and that really hurts. So please don't do that. The same lying and killing, you know that really hurts and harms. I remember teaching a group of kids years and years ago in Perth on what they needed to be taught Buddhism. And how do you teach a bunch of Christian kids what Buddhism is? And I said, look, in Buddhism we don't harm another person, we don't harm ourselves. So I asked them, what hurts? What hurts others? What hurts yourself? And they say, killing, stealing, committing adultery. Even kids know that. Lying hurts, and taking alcohol, that hurts yourself, hurts others. That's all the precepts are, all virtues, it's common sense. Not harming yourself, not harming others. Why would anybody want to hurt themselves or hurt the family they love? If you really thought about it, you would never be able to do it. The thing is, we don't really think about it. If they apply to all, regardless of whether or not we take them, what is the point of forming taking them? Indeed, you know that when I was growing up as a Buddhist, I started meditating first of all. I didn't know the five precepts. And at that time, I would go out with my friends to take alcohol, to take a beer, sometimes get drunk. But you know, the last time I took any alcohol was at this so-called smart university called Cambridge. We had every year the scholars' dinner. I was a scholar of that college, had the top 5%. And at the scholars' dinner, we had, first of all, sherry was served with butlers in tails in the old gallery, which was built by Sir Christopher Wren. I don't know how many glasses of sherry I had, and the best in the whole cellars of the college. This was the best top dinner of the year. And then we had a 9-course meal. Every course was served with a different type of wine. Again, the butlers hovering behind you, if your glass was less than half full, they topped it up again. And after the 9-course meal, then we went to the old library, where we had 3 glasses, one for port, one for claret, and one for Madeira, which also was topped up. And then, during the evening, there was this huge goblet made out of silver, encrusted with precious jewels, which was a college heirloom, probably was worth hundreds of thousands of pounds. It was filled with claret to the brim, and every scholar, student, and every professor at that college had to drain it, drink the whole lot, and then say the college toast in Latin. I went to that once, and once only. And that was supposed to be a good night out. I hardly remembered most of it. In the morning, I woke up in my bed. How I got back to my bed, you never know. When you're drunk, it's amazing, a miracle, you find your way home. And I woke up with a pile of vomit next to my pillow. Later on, I realized I could have died. Many people die choking on their own vomit when they're drunk. But I wasn't scared, I was just sick of myself. The first thing you see when you open your eyes, a pile of sick on your pillow. And I felt terrible and disgusting. And I was smart enough to think, what on earth am I doing? This doesn't make any sense at all. And that was the last time I took any alcohol. I said, that's it. I'm not going to do this anymore. It's stupid. It's dumb. And so I didn't take any alcohol. I was still very popular. I thought I would not get invited to any more parties when I stopped drinking. I got invited to more parties. Because they wanted somebody sober to drive them home. That's but only that, I'm saying this because I was a boy, they liked finding a nice girl, dancing with her, and then getting in a corner, kissing and touching her up, you know what boys do. And usually when I was taking alcohol, I could never remember that part of the party. The very best part I lost. Now I wasn't drinking. I was totally mindful of the best sensual pleasures. And look, if you're into sensory pleasures, then you're missing out if you take alcohol. You don't enjoy it as much. Because your mind is not there, it's drugs and alcohol. So the whole thing really is stupid. So anyway, I just gave up alcohol and I just gave up life because it didn't make any sense. Why should I cheat other people? And I became a vegetarian. And so when I went to the Thai temple in London, and I'd been going there for a long time, and they said, look, you've been coming here for many weeks now. It's about time you took the 5 precepts. And this is a true story. And I asked the monk, what are the 5 precepts? I haven't heard that before. And he said, you shouldn't kill. I said, well, I'm a vegetarian. You don't steal. I never steal. He said, you shouldn't lie. I always tell the truth. Committing adultery. I said, I've got a girlfriend. I stick with her. And he said, don't take alcohol or drugs. I gave them up about a year ago. So those are 5 precepts, Venerable. He said, yes. Well, I don't need to take them. I already keep them. I went away. So it's true, if you're already keeping them, no much point taking them, is there? It's keeping them which is really important. Unfortunately, in some Thai temples, I've seen them taking the 5 precepts, and they don't even intend to keep them. What they do, the first time I saw this, they had their hands up in Anjali, like you're supposed to do when you take precepts. And I saw them my finger down. I've never seen that before. And so I asked the man, he said, why did you put one finger down? He said, because, Venerable, I'm only keeping 4 precepts. They still chant all the five. And then when I look more closely, yeah, there's somebody with two fingers down, somebody with all his fingers. They still did the chanting, which was just empty ritual and stupid. So it's much more important to keep the precepts and take them. I've been reading some writings by monks trained in the forest tradition. I notice the word heart and mind are used interchangeably. I am confused. That's what we use in modern English. There's many, many words we use interchangeably. So this is just the local language. So sometimes we use heart, sometimes we use mind. It's just the way that people speak. Could you please explain if there are any difference between mind and heart in the Dharma context? What is the mind? Where is it located? Is it the brain or thought? Where is the heart? Does it refer to the heart organ or what? Okay, the heart and the mind are interchangeable. So where is the mind? That's a very good question. That's a very good answer. I will now prove to you where the mind is. Now, I want everyone to put their hand up in a minute, either the left hand or the right hand. You have to put one hand up, okay? Now, not yet, put your hand down. If you feel happy now, be honest, if you feel happy, put up your right hand. If you feel unhappy, your left hand. Okay, happy? Okay, now keep your hand up. So now, once you've got your right hand up, now can you please point to the happiness? Where is it in your body? Point it, please. Locate it. Are you imagining you're happy, or are you really happy? Where is it? Keep going, don't do that. You know why? Because happiness lies in your mind, not in your body. Just the same way you know a garden. By the trees, the flowers, the bushes, that defines a garden. So you know the mind by the happiness, the sadness, the anger, the depression, by the emotions. It's the emotions which define the mind. And because you can't actually point to the mind, it shows you the mind is totally separate from the body. And then open the door of your heart, there's a very beautiful story which just carries on from that simile, the way you can't point to your mind. And this was one of my friends from university. His daughter was in grade one at school when the teacher asked everyone in the class the question, what is the biggest thing in the world? Straight away, one five-year-old put their hand up and said, my daddy. My daddy. It's a five-year-old kid. It's very sweet. My daddy's the biggest thing in the world. Another boy put his hand up and said, elephant, miss, elephant is the biggest thing in the world. Someone else said, no, miss, mountain. Mountain is the biggest thing in the world. The daughter of my friend put her hand up and said, no, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. And everyone stopped. Even the teacher didn't understand what she meant. What do you mean your eye is the biggest thing in the world? Well, miss, my eye can see her daddy, he can see an elephant, he can see a mountain, and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. Isn't that brilliant? She's like, that was many years ago, she's now a genetic biochemist or something at Oxford. But it just shows that just how wise she was even as a five-year-old, a six-year-old. So he said, my eyes are the biggest in the world because everything can fit into it. When he told me that, I said, yeah, almost right, but not quite. Because your mind can see everything your eye can see and can imagine things you'll never see with your eye. It can hear, it can smell, it can taste, it can touch, but it's also got its own territory. In fact, everything which you can ever know can fit into your mind. Therefore, your mind is the biggest thing. You may notice I never said the biggest thing in the world, because the world which you can know lies within your mind. Everything that you can know can fit into your mind. Therefore, the mind is the biggest thing of all. Brilliant logic. Now you know why the Buddha said the mind is the chief, the forerunner of all things. Your whole universe, experiences, all fit into this mind. That's why you can't point to it. It's everywhere. And think about that. I'm trying to argue with that. It's very brilliant. It is said that true forgiveness happens when you realize what you've been holding on to, what you thought happened, didn't. Can you comment on this? That's also very true because, you know, we always judge We think we have the full story, but no one has the full story. You know, the chicken and duck story. Somebody actually gave me a piece of paper that got off the internet yesterday. There was a mouse be genetically modified to go tweet-tweet. So just because it goes tweet-tweet doesn't mean it's a bird. It could be a mouse. So that's why I said that just because the bird goes quack-quack does not mean it's a duck. It could be a mouse. So you said, no, it must be a duck, and you're wrong. So a lot of times we always think we're right. And remember what I said in that talk? Ajahn Chah's teaching, he said, you're right, but not correct. Brilliant. You're right, but not correct. And sometimes you're correct, but not right. Understand that, and you understand how to be forgiven. I've seen yogis shaking during meditation as though in trance. This is scary. Is this yogi possessed? Anything wrong? Now, sometimes that they have this pity, this joy comes up which makes you shake in happiness. So sometimes that happens and it's just nature. So it's nothing. You're not cold. It's not because the aircon is too hot, too cold. It's just that sometimes that body does that. Just leave it alone. It's okay. So don't be scared. If you ask a person who was shaking, they may have actually been remembering some rock song or something. Fantasizing about music, but no, it's more likely they're having a great time. I asked them afterwards, they said, I was enjoying myself so much, it's so wonderful. A friend who has a different religion asked, can you explain in some ways what is Buddhism about? I've spent the last 8 days talking all day and all day about Buddhism. And now you want me to explain it in Greek, that's unfair. Okay, my answer to them is that Buddhism is about the nature whereby there is suffering, realizing the cause of suffering, how to overcome and end the suffering. In the Four Noble Truths. Actually, he does not seem to understand. What would be the better answer? Okay, Buddhism is all about love, peace, compassion. Do people understand love and peace and compassion and freedom? So that's going to be my answer. My goodness, here we go. My mother was tortured by her stepfather during her childhood. The mother blames her caused her father to die young, despite she got a younger brother. She rarely smiled, even taking photos. Her mind always filled with bad memories. I asked her to forgive. She said she had forgiven her mum. If not, she wouldn't take care of her during her sickness. She said she can't delete those memories. How to help her delete bad memories? Thank you, Sergeant. It is the same way that, why is it, I mentioned this I think earlier, in your photograph albums at home. What photos do you keep? Do you keep the photos of your divorce? Do you keep photographs of when you were in hospital having an operation for cancer? Do you take photographs of when you were doing your homework at school? Or do you only take photographs of when you got your degree and graduated from school? You only take photographs of the marriage ceremony. You take photographs of when you're on holiday. You never take photographs of suffering, do you? Why? Because we have photographs to remember ourselves of happy times. Why don't you do the same thing in the photographic album between your ears? You know, just like your computer, you have a delete button. All the bad memories, delete, delete, delete. All the beautiful memories, save. We are perverse as human beings. We keep all the faults. We worry about the faults. It's just because we've been wrongly conditioned. As for me, all the faults I forget immediately. All the good things I remember. So that's what I would tell her to do. Find the link, I confess it could be. Ajahn Chah. Thank you for such inspiring talks. They really make me question and seek the truth. The other day you mentioned about how emotions manifest physically and to tackle the physical rather than fighting the emotion. Can you please explain again? Okay, you asked where the emotions are. Number two, how they feel. So, and three, start to massage them to let them disappear. Because when they have emotions such as anger, say, so you're getting angry at someone, you don't want to be angry, maybe your child. And you know, you're also a mother who's on the edge. And your kid said you're crazy, you're about to get angry, maybe hit them, which is a terrible thing to do. So how can you cope with your anger? Notice that the anger will manifest in your body somewhere. So the first thing is, where does it manifest? In your tummy, in your breast, in your top part of the chest. Where do you feel anger when you get angry? Number two, get to know it that well you can describe it in detail. What happens when you get angry physically? What gets tight? How it actually feels? Because once you get to know it physically, your mindfulness of the physical feeling is increasing. And once you get to know the physical feelings are pretty easy to deal with, especially massage, stroking, caressing, because that gets rid of a lot of the pain. It relaxes the body. So when you know that feeling, you get to know it very well, and then you massage it to relax it, you find that when you go back to the emotional cause of that physical feeling, that's gone too. Because the two of them are connected together. You try and stop being angry, and getting angry at being angry, that's double anger, it gets worse, you get a real mess. But you look at the physical feeling, where as human beings, we're much more in contact with our body, so we can actually relax our body much easier than relaxing the mind. So that's actually a way of dealing with negative emotions, by noticing how they manifest in the body, getting to know that feeling a lot, so you can give it many, many descriptions, and then massaging that area, so the physical feeling goes away, and the corresponding emotion will also go away. It's great with anxiety, fear before a great appointment, or whatever. I had a brief experience with TM, Transcendental Meditation, during one of the retreat participants were shown video clips of meditators levitating. Is it true? No, they weren't levitating. Sometimes they bounce up and down, but anybody could do that. That's not real levitating. Levitating is when you really go flying through the air, but be careful, don't meditate on this retreat. You'll hit your head on one of the fans. You take no responsibility for the cuts and bruises you suffer as a result. To me, it looks like they were hopping in full notice, exactly, but they can really hop on top of 2 feet of a mattress and can even do 50 meters hurdle, spin mats. That actually was just Photoshop did that one, apparently. So that wasn't actually true. They can't really do the full levitation. Ajahn Brahm, thank you for your inspiring talks. For those who like to accumulate wealth and stingy to themselves, how can we convince them that doing Dharma and serving others are meritorious deeds? Thank you very much, because in the end of your life, when you remember what you've done, what really counts, you remember the times you helped others. You remember your charity. You won't remember just how much money you spent on the casino. You won't remember just how much money you spent on the trip to Europe. But you certainly will remember the amount of money you spent on looking after a temple or giving it to good monks or nuns. Why? Because if you give it to a good temple or a good monk or nun, look at what they do. They help so many people get rid of their problems, their suffering, their pain, keeping marriages together, getting cancers to go into remission. This is what monks and nuns do in good temples. So you get part of the action. You're supporting the monks and the nuns doing the job of healing suffering. And at the end of your life, look, I remember even now, because I'm a monk, I don't have any money, so I can't give any money, but I really give my life to you guys. I work my butt off. Every time I go back to my room, I'm exhausted. Now, I talk all day and wait till 10:30, but I sleep very happily. Because I think, what have I done today? I've taught the Dharma even though I had a cold and wasn't feeling that well. I really worked hard teaching and I thought, wow, what a wonderful thing you've done. So if you make good karma, you feel it afterwards, it's beautiful. It just makes you so happy. When I was a student, I listened to a talk by a Tibetan nun. And she wasn't talking about Buddhism, she was looking after an orphanage in Kalimpong, in Sikkim. And I was so impressed with her work, the following day I went to my bank and took out 10 British pounds. That was in 1969, that was 2 weeks' food money for me. I didn't starve, but I went hungry. It hurt, physically, giving 10 pounds to this orphanage. That was the best money I ever spent, the best 10 quid I've ever spent in my life. To this day, I remember that. It always gives me so much happiness and joy. Even though I couldn't afford it, I did it. And that's why it's beautiful karma. So I did those things when I had money. So you did the same. Yeah, it hurts. You get so much happiness. What is the money for anyway? It's there for looking after society, creating happiness for you and your family. and also a future for your children. Not a future of wars, but a future of forgiveness and peace. So that's what you should be doing. Some practitioners talk about an afterlife to go to the Western paradise. Look, I came from the West, London. It's not a paradise. It's freezing cold. So if you like freezing cold, you think that's a paradise, and go to the West. And continue the practice of contemplation for life. Is this supported by the Nikaya? Not really. So the Western paradise actually came much later. Now, it's the time when people didn't know what was the West and the East and what was happening. You look at the world, then you go as west as you possibly can, you never find a paradise. Las Vegas? No. California? No. There's no such thing as Western paradise. Explore. If you can't afford the airfare, just go on Google and type in Western paradise. See Google Earth. What is your opinion on the Buddha boy who meditated under the tree in Nepal? He's said to be reincarnation of the Buddha. Buddhas get reincarnated. It was maybe a sort of a great monk or a great nun got reincarnated as that boy. Discovery Channel videotaped for 4 consecutive days without stop to see whether he's just another con man. It turned out to be true that he did not eat at all. Can you comment on this? Yes, sometimes people can fast. Not eating is okay. But the last I heard, it just disappeared. So sometimes people have this great good karma when they're very young, because they are reincarnated of a great meditator or a great monk from a previous life. They get reincarnated and they do some amazing things. But what actually happens later on in their life is usually they get to about 14 and their whole life changes. There was this one Tibetan monk, he's supposed to be the reincarnation of Lama Yeshe. He was a very famous Tibetan monk, especially in places like Australia. Still Lama Yeshe has got many, many disciples over in Australia. And when he died, he gave some clues about where he'd be reincarnated. They managed to find the reincarnation, and of course, that he was actually in Spain. And they looked after that boy, and now that boy has totally rebelled. And he said, you abused me by trying to train me as a monk. I don't want to be a monk. I want a girlfriend. I want to listen to rock music. I want tattoos. And so he's totally rebelled, which sometimes happens. So just because you were a great monk in your previous life, if you don't keep on doing the right things, then you just go back to normal person again. Now many people do swallow farming to get the bird's nest. During the harvesting process for the nest, many premature eggs drop and it's killed. How should we convince Buddhist devotees not to do this business in terms of my livelihood and karma? If it does harm other beings, then it is bad karma, so it's probably best not to do it. But I don't really know much about bird's nest soup. I know about tomato soup and pumpkin soup. The person is, I don't know much about. But if it does harm beings, it's probably best not to do it. But if you can do it without harming beings, no trouble. Can a Malaysian be ordained in your monastery in Western Australia? Yeah, they already have. Since you have such a huge following in Malaysia, have you ever thought of setting up a branch monastery over here to train a few local monks and nuns? Because I feel that many people are very inspired by Adjun and Charles Webb teaching the Dharma. Thank you. Oh, I'm so busy already. More work to do. Right, okay, so you set up the monastery. We'll send monks over there. Or nuns over there. Send a monk from each. Because actually there is already monks' monasteries. No, Vinayakachita's monastery. But how many monasteries are there for nuns in Theravada? In Malaysia? How many? Because even today, someone, one of the people here said they really, really wanted to become a nun. I have to think, where could I become a nun in Malaysia? So, half the people, actually, more than half the people in this room are women. So you do something about it. What historical moment or event do you wish you could have witnessed? The end of the talk. This quite a vast thing. What is the most significant challenge that society faces today? Too much work. If the person is not guilty about what they did, how do you forgive? They may think you don't mind. It's not that you don't mind. You say, it's your business, it's not my business. What you did is your business. My business is to drop it, because I don't want to carry your stupidity into my life. That's what you should do. And I have finally finished. I won't I'm going to ask if there's any questions from the floor, because otherwise we'd be here all night. So it's 10:15. Thank you for staying that little bit longer for tonight. I'm now going to do the sharing of merits for you all. And after sharing the merits, we can all go to bed and have a nice quiet time. I'm supposed to be quiet.